Welcome to The Book Show, and we're coming to you today from the Edinburgh International Book Festival. With over 750 events for readers of all ages, this is one of the world's biggest book festivals, and it all takes place right here in Charlotte Square Gardens, which is set up at the moment as a tented village for a 2.5 week long festival. And I'm joined now by Nick Barley, who is the director of the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and we are standing in a very busy Charlotte Square. There's a lot of people around for the festival, coming and going all day. But as you're here today, your job while you're here is very different, because year-round, I guess, you're in an office booking writers and you're not among the crowds.
That's partly true. I'm also spending much of my time travelling around the world meeting writers at other festivals. So, you know, I've been to Sydney and New Zealand and Guadalajara and Poland and Italy, various other countries through the course of the year. So, but yeah, when it comes to the festival time, then all of that hard work and all of that travelling pays off in terms of everybody coming together in this extraordinary space. Every day is like if you imagine one of your children getting married and you're hosting the party. I'm the host of the party, of the wedding, and everybody's really nervous and excited, and there's lots of tears and lots of passion, and by the end of the evening quite a lot of alcohol will have been consumed by some of them, so we're mopping up at the end. But basically I'm the host of a really fantastic literary party.
There's also a theme to the festival, and this year it's about using creative ideas to make a better world. How did you decide on the themes and why that one?
When I was planning this festival a year ago and imagining what the world would be worried about, I was aware that there was a big referendum coming up, a European referendum, and of course I had no idea which way it would go. I was also aware that there would be a Scottish election and that the SNP government here would be probably likely to win again. With these big changes, political changes, this is a time to wonder what's going on in the world and how writers can engage with that. And I realised that very often writers are in the business of imagining worlds. That's what writers do, novelists do. They imagine worlds in which stories take place. And I realised that actually those kinds of that ability to imagine is something perhaps we take for granted. You know, too often we think that the world is nasty and there's not much we can do about it. But actually writers can help us imagine how things could and possibly even should be better. And I felt a slightly sort of utopian urge to just insist that we have to imagine something better. It's not good enough to accept increasing poverty and the fact that so many people are suffering in the world today. You know, the migration crisis, it's not good enough for us to accept that that's going on. And writers should be part of trying to find a solution.
There's been controversy about book festivals in the UK and in Ireland and various places over the past year with high-profile writers, demanding that participants be paid. Where do you stand on this issue yourself?
This festival, except that some other festivals are different, and I would never criticise any festival organiser if they have to do it their way, because doing a festival's hard. However, the philosophy of this festival is an egalitarian philosophy. Everybody who comes here is paid. Every member of staff is paid. We don't have volunteers here, so we have a full payment system. Everybody who works here, it earns money, including the authors. And so, but the important thing is that we have a flat fee structure, so that for every appearance that an author makes in an event, they get paid the same fee, and that's £200 per appearance. But it's the same if you're a debut novelist or a Nobel laureate. And we think that egalitarian approach means that even if it is a relatively small fee, everybody accepts that it's the same for everyone. We're all in the same boat. And that very often the wealthier novelists accept that fee on that basis that they're getting the same as everybody else. And there's no division between them.
It's great to hear. It sounds very democratic. Also, it sounds like you have the best job in the world. I'm slightly jealous. It was great to talk to you. Thank you, Nick Barley. Well, just to the right of me here at the festival in Charlotte Square Gardens in Edinburgh is the very imposing bookshop, which is hard to resist. So I went in earlier to have a poke around and I met James Shaw, who's the head bookseller, and asked him, what are the biggest sellers here at the festival?
Well, they're buying lots of books. We've sold to date around 42,000 books. Our best sellers include Alexander McCall Smith, Julia Donaldson, the children's writer, and also Edna O'Brien.
Over the course of the festival, and it is quite a big and lengthy festival, how many books do you think you'll sell?
If it doesn't snow at the weekend, around 60,000, just over 60,000.
Is there an interest for people when they come in, specifically seeking out Scottish writers or local Edinburgh writers?
There is. Scottish books form a big part of the book festival. Certainly, in terms of our sales, books published by Scottish publishers by Scottish authors or books about Scotland would account for something like 20 to 25% of our overall sales. And then, of course, there are events that are related to a lot of these books.
The modern festival is a very new thing, and that we didn't necessarily sell books, so there was somebody with a box down the back. I mean, how do you feel that evolution has come about, and how important is it for the authors who are taking the time to come to the festival to sell books?
I think it's very important for the authors. I mean, one of the things that have really, you know, upped our game in this year is that we're now reporting our sales to Nielsen, who provide the weekly bestseller lists. So this means that the authors, you know, efforts, if you like, are rewarded. You know, when they appear here and we sell several hundred copies, that actually pushes them further up the bestseller lists.
Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
So here at the festival, authors from almost 50 countries have arrived, and they've brought with them their fans. Here's Ruby Wax, who is busy signing her book, A Mindfulness Guide for the Frazzled, after her talk.
Want me to sign this? Thank you. Oh, wow. Who's it to? Sorry, what's your name?
Rosemary. Iona. I-O-N-A. Sorry.
You forgot her name?
Yes,
no.
I did.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ruby Wax, we have caught you at the end of your very busy signing. What have you been doing here, and how has the festival been for you?
I've only come to do my book. Isn't that narcissistic? And tonight I'm seeing a drag act. Is that the Edinburgh Festival in a nutshell?
And tell me, how do you feel about the festival and the buzz? I mean, there's a lot of people here. The weather is gorgeous. What's it like for you as a writer to come to something like this?
Well, it's really important. A, I have to figure out what my book is about again because I've been on holiday. And B, you can compare your book sales to everybody else's, so you know where you stand. But I love this. I mean, this is culture. I just came from America, nothing like it.
What's it like? Because at these kind of things, you get to meet people. People come up to you and chat to you. What's it like to sort of come face to face and get to chat to readers?
You know, that's my favorite bit, is that you really focus and they tell you intimate stuff, which I love, but they never linger too long. So I get into their lives just for a few minutes, and it energizes you.
Well, thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of your festival, Ruby.
Thank you. Thanks for asking.
And thanks there to Ruby Wax. So from the Queen of Comedy to the King and Queen of Scottish Crime, I'm joined now by Val McDermott and Ian Rankin. And I wanted to start by saying, you know, in Ireland we have a lot of cliches about Irishness, you know, from Guinness and Shamrocks and Shillelaghs. And I guess in Scotland it's the same. You have, you know, whisky and haggis and all of that. But when I think of Scotland and the Scotland that both of you write about, that isn't necessarily the Scotland that either of you are interested in.
I don't think there's a single instance of shortbread in any of my books. No, I think we're writing about a Scotland that actually exists, as opposed to in reality, as opposed to in the imagination of the tourist board. So we have the same kind of problems that every other society has. We have the same kind of joys and delights that everybody else has. But it's not just cliches. We actually get behind the cliches to what's going on.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you know, I arrived in Edinburgh to go to university, and like a lot of other people, for me it was the castle and people playing the bagpipes on the street for money, and Greyfriars Bobby and all the rest of it, and museums and art galleries and statues. But, you know, when I got to know the place, I realised there was a real living, breathing city with real living, breathing contemporary problems there that I just wanted to write about, and I thought crime fiction was a good way of writing about the have-nots as well as the haves.
So you both use detectives as a way to get an angle on the city. With Rebus in Even Dogs in the Wild, he has access to the underbelly. And then Detective Piri, she wanders the city. She has insomnia. And at one point, she sort of encounters these Syrian refugees. And both of you in the past, whether that's been sort of Scottish independence or Trump or, you know, the G8 in your case, Ian, there's a way of sort of addressing the world around you that isn't, is it something that you do deliberately? Is it accidental? Or can you not avoid the wider world and not just write about the one place where the book is set?
Well, detectives have the great ability to access all areas. And the nature of the crime novel means that because you've got different social backgrounds for your victims, your witnesses, your investigators, your media covering the case, you can go anywhere in a crime novel. And it's not that I ever sit down with a theme. I don't start the book thinking, this time my theme is going to be homelessness or whatever. But because I live in the world, because I'm a bit of a news junkie, I'm interested in what's going on around me, I'm interested in politics, I'm interested in social politics, those things find their way into the book because they're things where stories exist.
Yeah, I mean, I think Val's wandered a bit more widely than I have. I mean, she's set books in England and elsewhere, and they haven't always been crime novels necessarily. I mean, I just seem to be obsessed with Edinburgh. I can't get away from the place. I've tried. God help me, I've tried. But it just seems like every time I think I know the city, there's something else that is revealed to me that I didn't know about, and I want to share that with a wider world. Or the city itself, because it's an organic thing, keeps changing. So as you've said, you know, the G8 comes to Edinburgh, that makes it a different city for a week or two. The Parliament arrives, independence referendums arrive, come and go. All kinds of things change. And so the city itself is not, although to the visitor's eye it might seem to be unchanged from year to year, Edinburgh's changing all the time, just below the surface. And you can bring that through in a novel, in a way that you can't if you're writing any other form.
I was watching the two of you walking across the grass to us here, just outside the press tent, and you were laughing away. And it's. I'm wondering how long you know each other, because you know each other quite well.
We've known each other since the early 90s, I think. Ian was living in France, I was living in Derbyshire, and we got in touch with each other because we were both publishing crime novels, and we were both from Fife and both roughly contemporary. And we actually used to write each other letters in the days when you didn't have email. We would. I'm sure those letters still exist. Have you still got your half of the correspondence somewhere?
I will have my half of the correspondence somewhere, possibly written on airmail, you know, you know, really, really light paper. Yeah. But anyway, first, because I knew that, because of the blurb on the back of our books, I knew that Val came from Fife, but I wasn't exactly sure where in Fife. And it turned out to be Kirkcaldy, which is 5 miles away from where I grew up. And yet the first time we physically met was in Seattle.
It was 1994. We're both at the American Mystery Convention, BoucherCon, and that was the first time we'd both actually been physically in the same place. Yeah. And so we arranged to meet for a drink. We were going to have a drink and go for dinner and be civilised. So we went to the pub and we were still there at closing time, singing with the band, as I remember.
I think you were singing with the band. I don't think I was singing with the band, but certainly music was involved at some point.
So clearly music is quite important to both of you. And in Even Dogs in the Wild, on the very page, the opening page, we have the Associates, the great Scottish band, the wonderful Billy McKenzie. Can you write while listening to music? Is it essential? Does it affect the story? Does it seep in? Or do you have to have utter silence?
Well, like a lot of crime writers, a lot of novelists, I'm a frustrated rock star. I'd much rather be in a successful band than be a writer. And I did have a go at it when I was 18. I was in a band in Fife called the Dancing Pigs, Fife's second best punk band. And there were two punk bands in Fife at that time, us and the Skids. They were much, much better. And so, you know, in the early Rebus books, he listens to a lot of jazz and classical, but then I realised there was Colin Dexter using classical music in his books with Morse, and then a guy called John Harvey had come along, he used a lot of jazz in his books, his Charlie Resnick books. I thought, I've got to get some distance between these characters. So I decided I would give Rebus, you know, rock music, and it would be the kind of music I listen to. I do listen to music when I write, but it cannot be anything with lyrics, so it tends not to be rock music, it tends to be electronica and jazz. There's always music playing, it drives my wife daft, because I'll put a CD on and just press repeat and listen to it for 8 hours through, and until my wife comes in and switches it off because it's driving her demented.
Yeah, I always have music on when I'm writing, and like Ian, I prefer not to have lyrics, either no lyrics at all or lyrics that are incomprehensible to me. So something in a foreign language like Wim Mertens, or something totally made up like Sigur Rós. But it ranges widely across jazz, classical, electronica, piano music. I wanted to be Joni Mitchell, actually, but I didn't have the hair. And I did a lot of folk singing in my teens and into my 20s, sang in folk clubs, sang with people like Barbara Dixon. That was my fallback. If I hadn't made it as a writer, I might have had a crack at making it as a folk singer.
And I've heard Val sing just at our last year at our birthday party, and her voice is still as good as ever.
Oh, thank you.
No. Still not got Joni Mitchell's hair, mind.
No.
No chance for duet down the road? Or?
No. Gladly no.
Well, let's talk about the new books. Val, in Out of Bounds, the novel opens with a group of joyriding teenagers, and there's a crash, and the driver is linked to a 20-year-old crime through sort of forensic evidence and a sort of familial DNA route. Where did you start with the storyline? Was it the forensics or was it something else?
The idea first sort of started to ferment in my head a few years ago. I was writing a non-fiction book about forensic science, and I'd gone to a conference of forensic experts, and one of the sessions I went to was led by two detectives from the Greater Manchester Force, who were the people who actually developed the use of forensic DNA in cold cases, and they were talking about how they'd developed it and how it had worked out in practice. And that started me thinking about when you get these familial DNA hits, everybody thinks, oh, well, that's just it, it's straightforward, now you go to the nearest male relative and you've got them. But I thought, well, these days we have complicated family structures. Things are often not quite the way they seem when you look at a family from the outside. What would happen if you started looking at that DNA and where it led you, and it didn't take you where you thought it was going to go? So that was kind of the starting point for the book, and then everything else kind of fed into it along the way. Aye, we got a hit on the DNA database. I don't pretend to understand these things, but it wasn't a direct hit. Well, it couldn't have been, because it ties in with a 20-year-old murder, and this laddie's only 17. The rustle of paper. Apparently it's what they call a familial hit. Whoever left his semen all over a rape victim in Glasgow 20 years ago was a close male relative of a wee Dundee gobshite called Ross Garvey. The adrenaline rush of reopening a cold case never faded for Karen. The rest of her life might have gone to hell in a handcart, but excavating the past for its secrets still exerted its familiar pull on her. Yesterday, she'd never heard of Tina MacDonald. Today, the dead hairdresser was front and centre in Karen's consciousness.
Ian, in your latest novel, Even Dogs in the Wild, Rebus, who's so familiar to readers, comes out of retirement and he's consulting on a case involving a gangster who he's a long-standing connection with. So what more did you want Rebus to say by bringing him out of retirement?
I don't know. When I start a book, I've only got the vaguest idea of what it's going to be about or where it's going to go. And, I had this kind of entanglement between Rebus and Cafferty, the villain who in the past has run Edinburgh, but he's now of a certain age, as is Rebus. And these are two men, you know, thinking the world is passing them by at a rate of knots, and they're kind of standing still and wondering if they have any validity left, and if they have one last good fight left in them. And that was kind of it. I just thought, you know, someone's apparently trying to get rid of Cafferty by shooting at him through his window. Who's doing that and why? And I didn't really know the answer to that until I'd written the book. So the book told me what the answer to that was when I finally got there. And, you know, I just thought it feels like a Rebus book. I mean, that's the kind of, you find a story you want to tell and then you decide which are the right characters to tell that story. People often say to me, how come Siobhan Clarke's never had a novel of her own? She would be a good character to use. And I've just never found a plot that felt like it was her storyline. And maybe one day I will, but at the moment it seems to be Rebus who always pops up, you know, with his hand up in the air saying, please, sir, me, this time me.
We also are familiar with Cafferty, so maybe we'll hear a section from the book where something quite shocking happens to him.
In his kitchen, Cafferty poured another whiskey, adding a drop of water from the cold tap and finishing it in two swallows. He expelled air through his teeth and slammed the empty glass onto the table before running his hands down his face. The house was locked, all doors and windows checked. From his pocket, he took the bullet, compressed from impact, 9mm, just as Rebus had surmised. Once upon a time, Cafferty had kept a 9mm pistol in the safe in his den, but he'd had to ditch it after having had recourse to use it. He placed the misshapen bullet next to the empty whiskey glass, then opened a drawer and found what he was looking for, tucked away near the back. The note that had been shoved through his letterbox a few days before. He unfolded it and examined the words again. I'm going to kill you for what you did. But what had Cafferty done? He pulled out a chair, sat down, and began to consider.
And that was Ian Rankin there reading from Even Dogs in the Wild. Ian, Rebus is sort of an unapologetic, hard-drinking cop, sharp instincts, but he has a knack for getting himself into trouble. What do police that you've met, or people in the Scottish Police Force, think of your depiction of him?
He's a dinosaur. He's a kind of cop who really doesn't exist anymore, or just barely exists, the kind of hard-drinking cop. I mean, I know a lot of them, I meet them at retirement dues, but they're all of a certain generation, and they're all pretty much retired now. The drinking is about to come to an end, actually, because the next book that comes out in November, he's got some health issues. So that's quite... I promised my wife I would do it, this book. She's been nagging me for years, saying, look, he's had this charmed life. Surely his lifestyle's going to catch up with him eventually, so it does in the next book. And he's got a dog now to walk, so he's actually getting a wee bit of exercise, which is rather unusual for him as well. So he just, he keeps... From book to book, he keeps changing and he keeps surprising me, and that's why I continue to write about him.
It's interesting to hear the sort of personal aspect of the character's life. And I think this is your 30th novel, Out of Bounds, Val. It's dealing with the grief since the death of her colleague, Phil. It also gives her kind of an empathetic sort of view in the reader's eyes, I think. Is the personal narrative of a detective in fiction as important? Is it important?
I think it is these days. You look back at the classics of the Golden Age, and it doesn't matter what order you read Miss Marple in, because she never changes. The only thing that changes about Miss Marple as time goes by is that her arthritis gets a wee bit worse. But there's no self-reflection, there's no these terrible things that have happened to me? What is it about me that brings these things on myself? I think readers have become much more sophisticated now, and they expect us to be more sophisticated in the narratives that we bring them. And both from the point of view of a writer, to maintain the interest in the books you're writing, and from the point of view of the readers who invest in the characters, I think it's important that you have characters who absorb their history and move forward, who change and develop, as we all do because of the things that happen to us in our lives. You know, trauma impacts on us, and so that alters the way we are in the world. And I think for our characters, if you had them going through all these traumas and just shaking them off, it wouldn't be very... There would be characters that readers would want to have an emotional engagement with so much.
Val, we touched on briefly the idea that you've genuine forensic detail in these books makes them, I think, more authentic and more interesting for the reader. And you did write a book, Forensics, The Anatomy of a Crime, a non-fiction book. What for you has been the most interesting development as a writer in terms of forensic science? Is it something like forensic entomology?
I found the forensic entomology stuff absolutely fascinating when I was writing the book. There were all sorts of things that came up that I had no idea about, like when maggots eat a body, they get the DNA of the body trapped between their tiny wee maggot teeth, which I think is amazing and gruesome and grim. But I often go back, and maybe it's because of my personal relationship with Professor Sue Black, a lot of the things that have happened in forensic anthropology in recent years in terms of identification have been quite revelatory to me. You know, the fact that you can take someone's teeth and you can tell from that where they were when they were 6 years old. There's apparently a small bone in your skull that if you analyse that can tell you where your mother was living when she was pregnant with you. Now that stuff to me is bordering on black magic, and I think it's absolutely fascinating. Every time I talk to Sue there seems to be something else that's been developed or some other aspect that's been given to something that they've known about for ages, and I find that really exciting, the way that the bits of your body, when you think that a skeleton that's been lying there for 20 years, you wouldn't think you could get much information from that, but actually you can get a wealth of information, and that to me is just always really engrossing.
I want to ask you both about, I know Val that you've spoken to BBC about fiction being a way to access truth, and you know the observations you might have on real-life crime documentaries. And I wonder, have either of you had any interest in watching or listening to, you know, podcasts like Serial or watching The Jinx or Making a Murder on Netflix? And do they have any effect on, not necessarily your own work, but just is it intriguing for you to watch how different people approach crime, albeit in the real world?
I'm quite uneasy about some of these reinvestigations of old cases. I'm uneasy on two grounds particularly. Inevitably, you're talking about something, a podcast or a television show that lasts for an hour at a time. There has to be heavy editorialising going on there. They're not showing you everything, every cough and spit of every interview. So they're making decisions about what to show the audience. Right away, you've got an inbuilt bias in what they're doing. And you as a viewer have no way of knowing where that inbuilt bias comes from and where it's leading. But the other thing that disturbs me, I think, and even more than that, is the way that victims get lost in all of this. It's all about these guys who've been accused of a crime, and it's almost as if the victims disappeared and become invisible. As a journalist, I covered plenty of cases of the aftermath of sudden violent death, and I know the kind of impact that has on people's lives, on families, on friends, on neighbours, and all of that somehow just vanishes. It just drifts away in these shows, it seems to me, and I think that if you lose sight of the victim, then the crime loses its meaning.
On the idea of that kind of narrative told over various podcasts or various episodes, is there a sense that either of you would be interested in sort of doing something with the novel, maybe turning it around a little bit, where you developed something over several novels as opposed to it all happening within 300 or 400 pages? Or is that terrifying?
Terrifying for me. I might not be around for the next three or four novels. I want to get it all. You know, I almost feel like writing the ending before I begin, just in case I'm not around for the rest of it. You know, when I read books and I read the end first, just in case I pop my clogs in the middle of the night. So I'm getting to a certain age where I can't conceive of doing anything like that. I remember being impressed by, what's her name, A's for Alibi, Sue Grafton. You think you knew at the start you were going to write 26 books.
Yeah.
Who knew they were going to be around for 26 books?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, in the next year's Zed. So, but I think in a way that if you have a serious character, that is what you're doing anyway. You are writing a novel in however many parts, because the character develops, they reference backwards to what's gone before, so those things do continue. I remember with P.D. James, I actually did P.D. James, the last event that she did with her, we did in London, and I said to her, are you writing? And she said, no, I'm not writing. I said, you are, aren't you? You really are. She says, well, I am. She said, but I'm telling everyone I'm not, because I don't want to leave a Dalglish novel unfinished and have one of you lot finish it.
It's been great to speak to you both, Ian and Val. I know you've got events to do, so I won't keep you here at the festival. Out of Bounds by Val McDermott is published by Little Brown, and Even Dogs in the Wild by Ian Rankin is published by Orion. Well, that's it for our special here from the Edinburgh International Book Festival. But next week, we'll be speaking to another Scottish author, James Kelman. So join us next Saturday at 7 p.m.